racial battle fatigue is the ways that our bodies respond to racism, right? Racial battle fatigue is not racism, it's our body's response to it. So we're talking about the context of being underpaid. We're talking about Brown versus Board. We're talking about all these things. And then it shows up in our bodies with irritability, increased drinking, increased smoking, panic attacks, hives, hair loss, resentment, right? These are all the ways that how we respond to it.
Voices with value, stories with soul, tools for transformation. This is Innovation Insights. Innovate so you do not stagnate.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we have a truly inspiring guest who is transforming the landscape of education and wellness for Black educators. Dr. Asia Lyons is the founder and lead designer of Lyons Educational Consulting, where she co-creates inclusive environments that empower Black educators and foster their self-actualization through wellness initiatives. Dr. Asia Lyons is the founder and lead designer of Lyons Educational Consulting, where she co-creates inclusive environments that empower Black educators and foster their self-actualization through wellness initiatives. With nearly 20 years of experience as both a K-12 educator and an adjunct professor at the University of Colorado, Denver School of Education, and Human Development, Dr. Lyons brings a powerful blend of academic research and practical knowledge to her work. Her expertise lies in examining the profound impact of racism-related stress and racial battle fatigue on Black educators and their families, a critical issue that influences both retention and well-being in the education sector. Through Lyons Educational Consulting, she provides equity audits, culturally responsive programming, and coaching to schools and nonprofits, helping them create systemic change. She is also the co-founder of the Black Educator Wellness Cohort, offering free monthly wellness sessions in the greater Denver area, and provides virtual and in-person wellness programming nationwide for educators of color. In addition, Dr. Lyons is the host and producer of The Exit Interview, a podcast for Black educators, where she amplifies the voices of Black educators who have left the field, shedding light on their challenges and what institutions must do to better support them. Her work has reached audiences at South by Southwest EDU, Harvard Graduate School of Education, the State of Black Learning, and many more. In today's conversation, we will discuss the realities faced by Black educators, the importance of wellness in education, and the systemic shifts needed for true equity. Dr. Lyons' insights will challenge us to think deeply about how we support educators and build sustainable, inclusive environments. So, prepare for an enlightening discussion with Dr. Asia Lyons, a powerhouse in education, equity, and wellness. Dr. Lyons, welcome to the Innovation Insights podcast. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate the invite.
Well, and just a little bit of background of how we connected. I started liking your posts on LinkedIn, and I think you reached out to me. I was like, hi, who are you? You did it in a very polite way.
Yeah, like I appreciate you always supporting my posts, reposting, sharing my stuff. I appreciate it. I really do. And I have to say that, like, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And I'm sure you were probably like, this strange woman. But really attracted me to what you're doing is that it's very intentional, it's supportive of Black educators. And as an educator myself, I just thought I just want to support that. And then also you're in Colorado and Denver, my hometown where I was born and still have family living in the metro area. So I was like, a Coloradoan. So
yeah, for sure, for sure. In Aurora, the famous Aurora, Trump's favorite city, unfortunately.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's bad.
That's unfortunate.
Yes, it is. I'm like, leave my little town alone. We haven't done anything to anyone, please.
I know. Oh, my goodness. Oh, well, let's start with you sharing your journey into education. And why did you become an educator?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I became an educator because someone told me that I was good with children. Good, you know, taking care of children. I went to school originally to college to become a chemical engineer. And I was planning to do that because my father wanted me to be a chemical engineer. And in my second year of school, flunked out of college. And in some ways was relieved because I didn't want to do that. And I was like woefully ill-prepared for like higher education period, right? I went to school in Detroit, and the school that I went to was supposed to be a top-notch school for the gifted. But when I got to college, I realized that wasn't necessarily the case. And so ended up leaving or getting kicked out of school for academics in my second year, but then went to community college in my neighborhood, decided I was going to go back. I wasn't going to just not go to school. So I went to community college, and I picked that particular community college because I didn't have a car, and the bus right down the street from my house took you there. So I said, okay, I went, I signed up, figured all the forms out and things, and was going into business administration because I still wasn't sure, but got work study at the preschool, a childcare center on the campus. And so I was like, okay, that sounds good. And was working there for maybe 3 or 4 weeks when someone told me, who worked there full time, I think that you should be a teacher. And so then I went home and I prayed about it. I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing in life. I don't know. And really felt in my spirit that I should go ahead and move from business administration to education. And I went there, finished up pre-education classes. And then the next bus stop was University of Michigan's Dearborn campus. So I finished up over there. And that was it. And yeah, I do love working with children. My house was always a house where we hung out as kids. It was like we call it Kool-Aid house. And so it made sense. And I didn't go into supporting preschool, like early childhood, but I always did enjoy working with children and helping to see that the light bulb go off, those moments. And so, yeah, that's how I became a teacher. And that's why.
Well, and I'm so glad that you mentioned your community college time, because a lot of times people don't think about that. I went to a community college too for my first degree. How do you think that helped your trajectory by going to a community college?
Yeah, well, first, I feel like I got my high school education when I was in community college. I just felt like all the things I should have known, all the classes I should have taken, or not necessarily that I didn't take them, but they weren't explained well, or they weren't taught well. That happened in community college. And I feel like my professors really cared. I think that they saw that if you were eager, you came to class and you tried, they put the time in, right? So I'm really appreciative of my community college experience. And I always tell folks growing up that was like, oh, don't go to community college, and this is for a certain kind of people. But I think that was the best thing that could have happened to me as far as my finances and paying for it, as far as being able to catch the bus, like I said, from my home to a place that was convenient. And I've met some good friends there. So I don't have any complaints, right, about my community college experience.
I agree with you. I'm pro community college too. I think it, you know, great experiences, great education, financially, really a good way to start out your education. So I think it's really, well, turning from that, so you taught for a while, right?
Yeah, 12 years.
12 years. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, so I have a K-6, or I had, because it's probably expired, but I had a K-6 license here in Colorado. So I moved from Michigan when I finished undergrad to Colorado to work, because Detroit was closing public school. Like, a lot of the public schools were closing. And so my boyfriend, now husband, said, like, let's try Denver. He'd already lived out here for a little bit. We came out here, and I taught fourth grade for a year. And then the principal asked me to loop up with my class. So I taught that same class in fifth grade. And I stayed in fifth grade and taught fifth grade for 5 years. And then I moved over to the middle school and taught math and social justice for 6 years, or math and math-oriented classes, and then social justice and math in the last 2 years of my career. So I really loved it. I'll be proud to say that I was that teacher. You know, like everybody wanted Mrs. Lyons, and they were so excited to have me. I had a good time in my classes. I felt like we had great relationships. My students, I hope that they feel they learned a lot in the class. And for me, especially when I taught middle school math, my goal was to destigmatize math. A lot of folks say, I'm just not good at it. I never will be good at it. And so my work was to kind of bring that fear down in students, you know, that they cannot be successful in math or have confidence. So yeah, and I also was that person who had the fish tank and the curtains and the couch, and it was a vibe. We had the lamps. We were doing all the things. And I loved teaching. I really did. It was great. And I think that it's so much to me in the ways that my school, especially in my elementary school, let me teach in the ways, of course, to the standards, but teach in the ways that were best for my children. It almost felt like entrepreneurship, because you could have this like wide open way of teaching as long as the students were successful and you could prove that they understood the concepts that were needed in the standard. So yeah, I loved it. I loved teaching.
You can tell, I mean, your body language, your smile, I mean, you just light up when you talk about it. You could absolutely tell. I'm sure you were just fantastic.
Yeah, I would like to think so, right? Once in a while, I run into my students out in community, and my oldest students are almost 30 now, and they, you know, they remember me, they say hi, I remember your class, so it doesn't seem like they're running away from me or don't want to speak to me, right? So obviously I did something right, at least I hope so.
Oh, I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did. And then now you're sharing that passion and enthusiasm and positive energy with your own business. So tell us about your business a bit more, and why did you start it?
Yeah, so I have a consulting firm, Lyons Educational Consulting, and it's gone through many iterations. But what I'm doing now in that business is supporting Black educator wellness. And that came about really at the tail end of my doctoral research time, my time in my doctoral program. So when I went back to school, and like I said, I taught for 12 years, but the reason why I stopped teaching is because I was a social justice teacher in the era of Trump in his first time in his presidency. And I had a lot of pushback, similar to what we're seeing now. But of course, it's not on the news because it's just one Black teacher in Colorado, however many of us were out there. But I experienced a lot of what I now know as racial battle fatigue in that teaching of social justice, and like the pushback that community, like white parents specifically, and my principal and her boss gave to me to like stop teaching social justice after I was given permission to do so. And so that was in the second year I taught it. I decided at the end of the year that I wasn't going to go back to teaching, because the ways that I experienced harm and racism related stress from those experiences, from that push out, from the parents mobbing me, I understood that if I came back into education, even a different district, the systems are the same, right? And so I went back to school. I applied to school in the fall, in the winter, but went back to school and studied the ways that Black educators experience racial battle fatigue from the workplace and how it impacts our families. And I did that research because it was my experience. I was experiencing racism in my workplace, and it was impacting my husband, it was impacting my daughter. And I knew that I wasn't the only one having that experience. And so I wanted to know what that meant for Black educators and the family members. So that's the research. And when I was coming to the end of that research, I had this idea to have a retreat space for Black educators. Like, what would it mean to have a space where Black educators could learn wellness and healing and be in a space with other educators who understand systems, the education system? And I reached out to a person on my committee, Dr. Ellie Cahill, and said, hey, I have an idea. And I reached out to her because she was already doing trauma-informed work in community with educators. I said, I have an idea. I would love to do a retreat space. And she said, yeah, that sounds good. And let's make it a cohort space with a retreat at the end, right? And so it started off, that pivot started from my original business, which was curriculum and program development, to wellness spaces by that first program, which is a Black Educator Wellness Cohort. And we started that 3 years ago. We're on our third cohort now. And so from that slowly, it was like, okay, what about some half-day retreats? What about talking about racial battle fatigue and rest and wellness and liberation at conferences? And then so on and so forth. So it slowly kind of grew and is still growing, but that's the work that I do now, is supporting the wellness of Black educators specifically. And then, of course, my podcast, The Exit Interview, a podcast for Black educators. I share the stories or interview Black folks who've left the field of teaching to share their exit story, because we're talking about recruitment all the time, but very not often do we talk about why people leave and let them tell their story of why they left. So all that kind of comes together in the work that I do.
And this is why you've just popped up on my radar. There's so many points here. First off, that you took your dissertation research and basically use that as a foundation for a business, which is so innovative and does not happen. You know, sometimes you'll have people that'll write books about off of their dissertation research, but to start a business, tell us what that was like to start a business and really have that research foundation too, to build it upon.
Yeah. And so, like I said, when I first started my business, it was not this. It was the curriculum development, program development, because that's what I did as an educator. And I knew that well. But what it was, again, this was something where I thought, you're saying this is so innovative. And to me, it was like, it just makes sense. Why would I sit and write 100 some odd pages on racial battle fatigue and then do what? Right? I felt like I needed to talk to folks about what it meant. So many people, when I explain racial battle fatigue and what it is and how it impacts Black folks in the workplace, they're like, oh my gosh, that's me. That's what that language is. And so it just made sense to continue to do that. Right? And so the cohort plus the, like I said, speaking engagements and other things pieced together. And it wasn't that I sat and said, okay, now let's just do a pivot. I'm no longer doing curriculum. I kind of set and slowly things started to come together. And so I found myself, instead of saying, oh, this is my side work, the cohort's my side work, it just slowly became my front work, right? It's no longer this thing I do on the side. And I just made a decision one day, like, hey, you're committed to this. You spend more time thinking about it and researching it and supporting people with this, and you love this more than writing curriculum, which every once in a while I still do if people ask and I know them well, but this is what's important to me. And I see the growth and I see the light in people's eyes when they're in spaces with other Black folks that understand their journey, you know?
Well, the thing is, I feel that your curriculum writing experience and background probably really does help inform the programming that you're creating, you know, because you know how to create programming for your cohorts.
Yeah, it goes together really beautifully in the curriculum that we've written for the cohort and really for our workshops and webinars does come from Dr. Ellie and I both being educators, right? But all that comes very, like you said, I've been doing it for so long that thinking about a curriculum that makes sense, that has these threads that we need to talk about healing, it makes it much easier to have a background in education. At least for me, it does.
Yeah. Well, you've used the terms racism related stress and racial battle
fatigue. Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about those terms and explain what they are?
Sure. So racism related stress is a manifestation of racism in the ways that it shows up. So there's 6 different manifestations of racism. And Lord knows that my brain's going to forget one of them. But basically, there's the generational transmission of group trauma. So the ways that we think about racism coming through the generations. So when I talk about that, I always talk about Brown versus Board and how that impacted Black educators. We have contextual racism, which is like racism that happens in the context of something. Like most, for example, in Colorado, We're finding that Black educators in early childhood are paid around $3.50 less than their Black or brown or their white or brown counterparts just because they're in the ECE, right? Same education status, same zip code that they're teaching in, $3. And we already know ECE is underpaid, right? And then we have microaggressions, which we're very familiar with, which is that those constant slights. We also have, and so now you're making me do my stretching my brain. They'll come to me. But the point is, there's like six different ways that racism shows up. And we know that happens all the day long. It's happening to us in our community. It's happening in the workplace, right? And racial battle fatigue is a way that our bodies respond to racism, right? Racial battle fatigue is not racism. It's our body's response to it. So we're talking about the context of being underpaid. We're talking about brown versus board. We're talking about all these things. And then it shows up in our bodies with irritability, increased drinking, increased smoking, panic attacks, hives, hair loss, resentment, right? These are all the ways that how we respond to it. And the reason why Dr. Smith, who coined that term, talked about it being racial battle fatigue is because our bodies are responding as if we were in war, right? So it's the same type of experience. It's a trauma. And so that's what racism related stress is, and that's what racial battle fatigue is. Racism related stress is racism, right? Racial battle fatigue is how our bodies respond to it. And the time it takes coping with that. The 10 minutes of thinking about it in the car, the 20 minutes laying in bed, can't sleep, the 2 hours rehearsing what you're going to say next time you talk to that person, right? On and on and on, how all the minutes and hours that add up for us to cope with this stress, whether that's, like I said, it's the drinking, the smoking, the increased spirituality, all of these things.
Mm-hmm. So what are some methods for individuals going through racial battle fatigue to cope with it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that selfishly, I always say the first thing that I would say is find community. And I know that people think about affinity groups in their workplace as a place for that, but that's not necessarily the case. And I say that because a lot of times our affinity group spaces at work are run by people at work who are not going to tell you it's time for you to leave this job. Or this is who you should report to, and here are all the steps, right? Because that person also has to keep their job. And so I would say that one of the things that I think that people should do is find a healing and wellness spaces, either online or in person, with folks who understand their lived experience, right? And this is especially for those who are not prepared or not ready for therapy or want something beyond therapy or can't afford it at this moment. There's something about places that are not therapy, but therapeutic, that can be really healing for people, especially if they're consistent once a month, every 2 weeks or something like that. So it's going to come up soon. It's consistent. The people who are there are typically always there. So I think that's one thing that we should consider. Dr. Smith came on the podcast and he talked about being in nature. Like, what does it mean to be in nature? To move slowly, put our feet in the sand, and just like take some time for rest. He also talked about having our homes be examples of Black love and Black excellence. So if you ever see Dr. Smith on YouTube or anything, his background is like African art and paintings and things like that, right? And that's something that works for him. Dr. Sean Jenright came on the show and he talked about this need to microdose wellness, which means basically small amounts of wellness all day. So yes, of course we need a vacation. Yes, of course we need retreats. Yes, of course. Like, all those things are great, but we can also just drink water, right? We can also, and I was just talking to someone about this yesterday. We were having the same conversation, and she said when she was an assistant principal, her ankle stayed ashy. She was such a rush to she didn't put on lotion in the morning. Dry. So what does it mean to take that lotion and go all the way down to the big toe? It's kinkum, right? Even that, like lotioning our body is microdosing wellness. We should not be walking out of our house with dry ankles, right? That counts as wellness. And I know, I'm like,
Yeah, I've done that. Sometimes I forgot to put makeup on either.
Yeah, because we're always running. So, like, that's a beautiful example of between now and the vacation to wherever you're going to go, put the lotion on. Throw on the earrings if that makes you feel good, whatever it is. But we have to take back some of this time that's being stolen from us by saying, no, I'm going to drink my coffee at home. Or no, I'm going to stop by the whatever and pick up this thing before I rush off to work. I'm not going to jump out of my car and run into my office. I'm just going to move slowly and intentionally. And that's a way to be well as well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for those tips.
Yeah.
So who's your target market? Is it mainly K through 12 currently, or are there higher ed academics or educators that are also involved within your cohort?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for the cohort right now, it's early childhood educators, paraprofessionals, school psychs, all the way to principals. What we're really working on is we want to kind of back up and support pre-service educators. Yeah, yeah. So when I was in grad school, I taught a pre-service teacher class at the CU Denver. And at CU Denver, I had maybe out of the six semesters that I taught, three Black women maybe. And all of them were experiencing racism when they were placed in their class, their classes at the school district, right?
Of course.
To get their hours. And so they would come to me because I'm the only Black person that they know at the university at that time. And like, this is happening. Is it just me? And I'm like, no, that's racism. And so try to talk to them. And one person asked me, will I experience racism when I become an educator? The answer is, of course you will. And to us who are out here doing this, like, well, of course. But they're not prepared to take care of themselves. And so we're waiting until my folks in my cohort are typically 8, 10, 15 years in. We want to get to taking care of folks and giving them tools at year zero, year negative two. So they know, so they understand boundaries, which we talk about. So they understand finding joy and liberation. So they don't understand racial battle fatigue so that it doesn't sneak up on them. So yes to higher ed for folks who are in higher education. Mm-hmm. That's a great goal for us to have. But as far as like the being able to pay for those things and funding and how do we use our grants wisely and how do we make our connections wisely? We want to work with pre-service educators first.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And I love that you're thinking about individuals, at zero, as they're finishing up their education, doing their student teaching or placement or practicums and everything. Because it probably is I can't even imagine what a shock it is when they go into a classroom environment and then the deal of racism that they weren't maybe dealing with it differently on campus, but going out to that first time in a practicum and.
Yeah, the shock. I think that's a part of it, right? Is seeing educators kind of behind the scenes, where it's one thing they used to be in front of the educator as a student. But now they get to see them when they're grading papers and hearing them talk about Black and brown kids, right? And hearing them say these things that are like a gut punch. Like, how do you, then you realize like, oh, these folks are just like the folks at the bank and the folks at the King Supers and the folks. These are just regular folks who have like, and sometimes like limited thinking and belief about Black people. And like, what do I do with that as a teacher who doesn't want to get in trouble because I need this practicum or I need this job? But I want to advocate too for my students and how do I take care of myself in between? So that's why it's so important. And we've been really trying to talk to universities about partnership and them paying for it, right? And saying like, hey, can we come on board to support your folks? And so hopefully that will be the next phase of our work.
That's good. That's really good. I feel that, those of us that go into education feel that there's maybe a higher moral ground than education, that educators are going to treat people well and are there to help everyone. And then you get that bucket of cold water thrown on you when you do hear someone making derogatory comments about a student of color.
Yes.
And or treating colleagues that are of color poorly in a racist manner. So,
yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for unpacking that.
Really, of course.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, of course.
Now, I know you have your podcast and I love it. And I try to catch clips of it when I can. And one thing that really struck me that you said earlier is that the right to tell your story. And that was one reason why I started Innovation Insights too, is that we all have a story. We have a right to tell our story because many others tell stories about us. And sometimes they're not very flattering, favorable, or truthful.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Tell us about your podcast. And again, I love that you're looking at educators that have decided to leave and having them tell their stories.
Yeah, so the podcast, I'll start with the why. That year that I left education, at least in K-12 in that traditional sense, that summer I emailed my assistant, or I emailed my superintendent and said, "No, I'm demanding an exit interview from you. Like, I'm not going to leave, be pushed out of education, and you're just going to continue hiring and harming Black people." And after several emails, he finally responded and said, "Okay, let's do an exit interview." So the superintendent, and they don't offer exit interviews in that district to this day, and that was 2018. And so I had an exit interview. I had my list of things I wanted to say, and I said everything on that list because I'm like, he's going to hear all my 2 cents. And you know, of course, his response was, "We in the such and such school district are striving for excellence." And I didn't expect for him to think that what I was saying was going to be groundbreaking and he's going to change his ways. The point was that I said what I needed to say. And so when I walked out of that exit interview, I was walking back to my car and I thought, there's so many Black folks who leave education and never share our story. Either we're offered an exit interview and we don't share the full thing because maybe we want to get a job again and we don't want to burn bridges, or we're not offered anything, or we run away because I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to think about it. And so the podcast came from that why of like, there's so many of us whose stories deserve to be archived, especially when we feel like there's so much money, there's so much focus on recruitment, and there's never this collection of exits of like why you couldn't retain Black folks. And so that's why the podcast exists, to say you can't say that you didn't know why we're leaving. Because here, and today is March 20th, here's 60 plus episodes so far to tell you exactly why people have left and what they believe that you all can do to keep us. So that's why I exist. That's who I interview. And I also talk to and interview folks who are in counseling and therapy to say, "Hey, I got folks listening to this podcast who are healing from harm in the workplace, or who are going and want to just kind of think about how to be like just well." And I ask folks, like I talked about Dr. Jenright and Dr. Smith, like what people can do to be well. So it's a small amount of folks who are healers and therapists, but mostly it's Black folks who've left education, higher ed, ECE, K-12.
Do you know of any statistics about how many Blacks are leaving education? I haven't looked any up, and I'm really curious.
Yeah. I would say that I don't know if anyone really has like a solid guess. And the reason why I say that is because I was talking to one of my good friends, Jaleesa, who runs the Black Educator Advocates Network out of California. And part of the work that she's doing for policy change is that they don't have on open record the California Department of Education how many Black folks are in education. So they don't even have a count. So how can we know who's leaving if we don't have a count of how many people are there? And so, yeah, that's interesting information to know. And maybe, of course, different states have different data, but across the United States, unless people are counting us and watching those numbers shift, we will never know how many of us are leaving education.
No.
Yeah.
And this is the cynic in me. It's probably data that people don't want to know.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. People like, we should have more exit interviews. Why don't we have exit interviews? If you think about it, if you have exit interviews for every person who left education, and let's just drill down to Black folks, and in a school district, if out of 50 Black people who left that district in a year, 10 or 15 of them named the same person, and you were able to pull a core report and say, like, oh, this person's causing, you have evidence. And why would a district want to hold evidence of racism and trauma that they're supporting? So if you don't have the evidence, then no one can say, let's pull it out. There's nothing to pull out. They know what's happening. They know who's leaving and why, but there's no record to keep them from getting in trouble. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. That knowledge is power. That data can be power. And no, we don't want that.
Yeah.
So what are some of the themes that have come up for the reason why people are leaving? Why are Black educators leaving?
Yeah. So a small amount talk about pay, but most of them aren't leaving because of pay. Most of them say the reason why how we can be retained is pay, but they didn't leave because of pay. So that's the difference. A lot of them, and I end up with a lot of Black women who come on the podcast, most of them are experiencing racism. Some of them are experiencing toxic masculinity at the hands of their Black male colleagues. Yeah, that's been a one that comes up a lot, is that there's this, like, they think that their Black male colleague is going to support them, and they end up just, like, diminishing their voice. Many of them, just recently, we have quite a few folks who would talk about starting charter schools and the burnout from trying to start a charter school and be all the people in the charter school and boards running out of money and money disappearing and all the things. Yeah, that's a huge one. And then obviously there's always other reasons, like people just ready to move on. But I think the biggest ones that we see is just like a lot of racism, a lot of harm from colleagues in the work. I haven't heard, at least not in recent memory, harm from students. It's a lot of it is from the colleagues and the administration diminishing their voice, making them, all these pieces that the overwork to overcompensate is why people decide to leave.
Yeah, that all makes sense. And being in higher ed, many of those same,
of course,
translate over to that, those same themes. Absolutely. So if you were to have the opportunity to speak to a school board and they asked you, Dr. Lyons, what would be your suggestions that we could implement to support and retain Black educators within our district? What would be some suggestions that you would give that school board?
Yeah, so this is a really good question. I think that I'm all about the collaborative, like working in collaboration with folks. So the first thing that I would do is I would say, I need you all to find the Black folks who've left your district in the last 5 years to interview them, and then ask them. Because people can get really caught up in, like, the consultant said, do this. Right? But this consultant worked in Colorado. And she did not work in Tennessee. She did not work in Mississippi. She did not work in California. And so you get caught up with, you said this was going to work. No, let's pull data. You go in, eat your HR, get out the phone book, and you go and find as many Black folks as you can who have left your district in the last 5 years and ask them, why did you leave? What do you believe that we should do to retain Black education, and so on and so forth? And you use that data to inform what you need to do, because they live that experience every single day. I did not. Yeah. Right. But that takes a lot of work, because one, that means that you're going to have a lot of folks who don't even want to speak to you all. Right. Or are very angry still. And so you have to contend with that. And then again, it's not the consultant that you can go back and blame that it didn't work. It's you, that the responsibility is on that district or that university, because They told you what you needed to do. And if you didn't do it, that's on you, not on the consultant. So that will be for anyone out there. Take that for free.
Yeah, I love that. I love that because also by interviewing those people that exited and not just trying to say, okay, Blanket, you need to do these five things and this will keep all, you know, this will keep all your Black educators there. These are the five things you need to do.
Yeah. They love a checklist. Everybody loves a resource sheet. Yeah.
Oh, all that didn't work. But to get that qualitative data, those stories, that information, analyze it. Because also the context, like you said, it might be Tennessee, but it might be a school district in a certain area. And then the culture within that school district or the schools or the people, you know, so you're really digging down and getting some specifics.
Yeah, and I'll add one more thing. And interview their spouse or the person who's lived with them, their child, if they have an older child, like a college student, about the experience. Now that is because we don't go through anything joyous or harmful alone, most of us.
Yeah.
And so to hear, when we, and I say this all the time, when you get hired at a place, you call, you text people, you're talking to your sister, your loved one, you all those things. And when you experience harm, you also call and text. And so if you want to heal community, you have to do the work of not just talking to the Black educator, but talking to the folks around them who saw them breaking down and falling apart and were a part of that being yelled at or the tension. How many divorces did this cause? How many families are broken up because of racial battle fatigue that person was experienced because of harm has happened in their workplace? They need to find that out too, because we don't, Black, white, or otherwise, we don't live in this world alone. Everything we do has a ripple effect.
That is brilliant. That is really brilliant. And I haven't heard that individuals talk about, look at that person's community, ask them, interview
yes.
them, get
yes.
information from those closest, because they see it. I mean, I've had family members that have lived with me or talked with me or watched me go through challenges as an academic. And I know they would have a whole lot to say.
Yes. Yes. Because they also stay up at night thinking about that situation. They also, and that's a part of the research that I did, was it's the spillover and the crossover of the harm from the workplace to the home. That's why for me it was so important in my doctoral research to interview the family, right? Not just the individual. I needed to know, I had 10-year-olds I was interviewing. I had college students I was interviewing. I had spouses, because all of that matters. They don't just hold that. People take that home with them. Even when they think that they've processed it and they're like, I know, I feel, your family knows. They know when you're off.
Right.
All yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right. And so let's take that a little bit further, because it impacts the family, which then also impacts the Black community as a whole.
That's exactly right.
So what are your thoughts about that?
About?
We think about, okay, oh, this poor educator, they had a hard time.
Yeah.
Poor them.
Yeah.
You know, they just need to toughen up. But now we've talked about, okay, it's impacting their family, but then that also impacts the larger
community.
Black community too.
Yeah. No, 100% it does, especially because we have folks, you know, if you're a Black principal here in a school district and the family communities come to you, they choice into your school, they're driving there, and then you no longer are working there, that's impacting. Where all these folks came here for that Black educator, right? So, of course, it impacts community. It impacts folks who are wanting to be educators because they see that principal at running that school. And that's the part that I think that also education systems, higher ed or otherwise, forget, is that when we disappear off the front in front of these schools and classrooms, that's you're also recruiting in the opposite direction. I call that pull out versus push out. Now it's like, I don't want to be a teacher because my favorite teacher got fired. Why would I want to be an educator if my such a, and so on and so forth. So obviously it impacts community.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does. And I think so many ways, because I also was thinking too, that, okay, if your 10-year-old child is watching you go through trauma as a Black educator, not only do you not want to be an educator probably, but that is probably impacting you in school, your life, your relationship.
Exactly.
You know, your relationship with your friends, you know, how yes. you're dealing with things. Yes. So it just multiplies.
It does multiply. And I think, yeah, that's the piece when, again, going back to the research component, when I talk to folks, I had a mother-daughter pair that I interviewed. And in the interview, the daughter turns to her mother. So I interview the teacher, the educator first, and then I come to a second interview for whoever they choose as the person they want to interview. And so in the middle of the mother-daughter interview, the daughter turns to her and says, "Mom, I don't share what's going on with me and what's happening in me at school because we talk so much about racism that's happening at your workplace. I just don't even share anything with you because I don't want to overburden you."
Oh, yeah.
And so she's the relationship with her mother. And so she may be stuffing that down. She may be sharing that with her friends. But all of that changes that child.
Absolutely.
And how they show up in community and how they sit in class and think about their mom. And she had that meeting today. She was talking about that. I hope everything worked out. I'm going to text her after this class. And instead of focusing on their academics or their friendships or whatever, they're thinking about how their parent is coping with the racism that they're experiencing in the workplace, on top of their own racism that they may be experiencing as a Black child in the school or a multiracial child or whatever at a school. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's such a domino effect. And people just don't realize that, yeah, you might be just lashing out at one Black educator, but you're impacting the whole community. And maybe you're getting joy out of that in your whole.
More than likely.
Yeah. But
yeah,
as Black educators, we have to realize that and think of ways to help mitigate that.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, and also, I love your method for your dissertation research. And it's, you know, and what you just explained about how you interviewed the educator, then they were able to invite someone else in to be. And so you did those together, too. I mean, that's really, yeah, a nice model. And
yeah. Thank you. The IRB process, as we all know, was painful to be able to interview children, but I felt it necessary.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, when you said that earlier, too, I thought, oh, my gosh, that IRB must have been a nightmare. And for our guests that don't know what IRB is, for educators who are doing research and working with humans, you have to describe the process and how you are interacting with the humans, because there's historically been some research done that did not treat humans well. And we won't go down that rabbit hole because I'll get up on a whole my soapbox about that. But working with protected groups, and children are a protected group, so anyone under 18, there's extra precaution that has to go into that because they're young and impressionable. And
yeah,
but kudos to you for doing that.
Well, it was, you know, my research was me search. Right. I had to know that I wasn't, like, it wasn't just me. And I love the experience, and I love that my committee just said, like, do it, just go. Right. Because I know so many folks whose research committees very much stifle their creativity. And my committee chair, shout out to Dr. Antoine Jefferson, he said, like, let's just make sure this is really tight and that we come in there, we're ready to rock and roll. But he definitely supported me all the way with doing this work. And I'm grateful for that because, again, it didn't just get printed out and put in a drawer. It's supporting community these 3 or 4 years later, and it will continue to support community as long as I'm alive.
And thank you for mentioning that, because there's so many Black scholars, doctoral students who are just being challenged. And we were talking a little bit about this before we turned on the microphones and started recording about talk about racial battle fatigue and trying to get through their dissertation. And so just, again, thank you for doing that, because it's hard to do a dissertation to begin with. But then when you're facing resistance from your committee, your advisor, others in the department that you're at the university that you're working, it's tough.
Yeah, especially when folks, you know, people who are in my same, they were my same cohort, but had different advisors. They were getting pushed back about capitalizing the being Black for Black people, or like, oh, that's too much. Are you doing? And yeah, I thank God that I was in a place where, and you know, advisors, they don't take everyone. And so for my advisor to say, okay, I believe in what you're trying to do, I'm going to take you on as a student, as a doctoral student, I was super grateful. And we still, Dr. Jefferson and I still have a relationship today. I just talked to him last week. He invited me out to an event. And yeah, like I said, I'm just so grateful for him. And Dr. Ellie, who was on my dissertation committee, and Dr. Amy Farrell, who was also on my committee, just great, great people.
And those of you that are doctoral students are thinking about getting a doctoral degree, that is the type of relationship you want with your committee. You want to feel supported. You want to be supported even after you graduate.
Absolutely.
So look for that. Don't just take anyone to be your advisor. You need to do your research ahead of time and make sure that you're going to be supported during the process and after the process. And every episode, I get on my soapbox. And so thank you for letting me get on that soapbox.
Of course. I'm up there with you. Listen, scoot
thank
over.
You. Thank
scoot
you.
Scoot over.
All
yes.
Right. All right.
Yes.
Join me.
That's right.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Lions Educational Consulting. So you do equity audits and culturally responsible programming. What are some success stories that you can share with us?
Yeah, I think that my biggest success story is the cohort, the Black Educator Wellness cohort. And I say that because when we first started this programming, we had five folks or six folks, and we had to beg people to trust us. We'll know what we're doing. And that first cohort, we had 7-8 sessions, and then we had our retreat, and those folks really connected deeply and found community within each other. And then we had our second cohort. Instead of begging, we had 12 people. We only take 8 folks maximum. So we had 12 people, and then 8 people we were able to take on. And then this time we had 50 folks who applied and could only take 8 people. And that's a testament to the people in the cohorts talking to their community about the work. Because all we put out a little flyer here and there, and we say, cohort folks, tell your people the applications are open, right? And so to see like I said, this particular cohort was all women. Usually we ask women and non-binary people. It's open to Black women and non-binary folks. But to see the cohort, we just had our session for March last 2 weekends ago, to see them and the joy and to watch the transformation of so many folks just kind of burnt up and having burnout and experiencing trauma, which are not the same. And then coming through the cohort and seeing that light shine brighter, to see they found community, that you see people literally say, I didn't believe in Black wellness. I didn't believe in this, but I believe now. And you could tell that's the thing that I think is the most beautiful work that I do. And I co-facilitate, like I said, with my good friend, Dr. Ellie Cahill. That's the work that I think, and I would think that she would say the same thing. It's just to see that and to know that next year will be cohort 4 starting in September, that God willing and the funding stays, we're expanding our work to not only just work with our cohort of 8, but then to also work with their families.
Oh, love it.
Support wellness in the family. And so that's what I'm loving right now. It's like, what does that look like to train others to do this work and expand it, right? And of course, people think, oh, it's for retention. It's for wellness first. It's for healing first. It's for community first. And then if folks choose to stay, that's fantastic. But that's the thing that I'm most proud of, is that work. Yeah.
That is fabulous. It's just, I've watched it grow just in the small amount of time. I think I've been following you for maybe 6 months online. I can see a difference in growth. And a question about the cohorts, are you meeting in person or are they virtually?
Yeah. So all of our folks they're out in the Denver area. I mean, if people want to drive in, it's up to them, but it's, you know. So the cohorts that we have that are paid for by grants. So Ellie, Dr. Cahill has a nonprofit that we run this through. So we partner, yeah. And so the grants that we receive are for local. And so we'll meet one Saturday a month from 9 to 1:30 at a community college. So we're very mindful not to have it in a school building where people have experienced harm. We don't want to hold it in a school building that folks are working in. And then we have office hours in the middle of the month. And then we also have a text chat. We check in on people and we make sure they check on each other. And so we do that, like I said, from September until May. And then in June, we do a 3-day retreat in the mountains where we rent out a 8-bedroom house. And we just spend that time just really connecting and healing strategies and hanging out in our pajamas and taking walks and being in the sun and moving slowly. And then we end the retreat. Ellie and I stay up for one more night to debrief. We shut it down for July and we're back up again in August. And so folks can, like organizations who are teaching adjacent, like your Teach for Americas or things like that, they can purchase or we can provide that service to their folks, their cohort. We have a cohort coming up for a preschool program that's going to be for early childhood educators coming up in September, where we have that same cohort model, but it's a paid service. So that's what we offer.
Oh, that's wonderful. So if someone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So my email address is asia@lionseducationalconsulting.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn under Dr. Asia Lyons. As most folks know, I am on LinkedIn just about every day because I'm posting about the podcast or about the work that I do. But yeah, I'm always up to having conversations with people about the work, how to partner, keynote speaking, and have me come down and talk to your communities about the work that we're doing or ways to support the work elsewhere. Yeah.
We'll make sure all the information also is in the show notes too, so that people can get a hold of you. So as we come to the end, I asked every guest this question. How do you define innovation?
Yeah, I define innovation as the ideas that we come up with either individually or in a group when our mind is wide open.
I like that. That wide open mind. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Like when there's no limit to the way that we can think about a thing, when literally the beyond the sky is a limit, and when the ideas come to us in that open place, that's where real innovation can begin to transform the way that we do things.
Yeah. Oh, great. Love that definition.
Thank you.
So thank you for that. And just thank you for being here today. This was fabulous. I've learned so much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I've enjoyed my time. I appreciate you, like I said, supporting all the work that we're trying to do, always reposting, always sharing. So thank you so much also.
Oh, my pleasure. I've spent most of my time in higher ed. I have done collaborations throughout my career with K-12. And I really feel that higher ed and K-12 educators really need to spend more time together. Not that there's any time at all, but you know, if there's opportunities to support each other, I think it's so important.
Yes, agree.
Well, again, thank you for being here. And to our guests, thank you for listening. And please make sure that you follow Dr. Asia Lyons and her work and her team's work. And make sure that you check out the Exit Interview podcast. Also, if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, leave a review or a comment, share it with your network. It helps us to continue to bring you powerful conversations like this one. And as we wrap up, as I always say, make sure that you keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.